The president's own Justice Department now accuses him, or at least individual one, of directing illegal payments during the 2016 presidential campaign. Special Counsel Robert Mueller and federal prosecutors in New York released a series of memos late Friday. They detailed evidence provided by the president's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. He alleges that he acted at the president's direction in paying hush money to two women who claim they had affairs with Mr. Trump, affairs that Mr. Trump denies. Let's go to former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. And Rob, explain, first of all, these sentencing memos. Are these typically released publicly?
Well, they can be. I think in this case, it was important to the Mueller investigation to release them, to lay out the groundwork. Keep in mind, he's filed it with the court, so it becomes a public document. Mm-hmm. So there's a question of when it becomes public and how much it's, not promoted, but publicized, if you will.
Because it seems like it's kind of a tease, right? I mean, especially the Michael Cohen one, which mentions individual one, a.k.a. the president, something like 30 times, doesn't charge him with anything, but clearly implies that this stuff was done at his direction. Is there a political reason for releasing this, or is this just standard procedure? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, because it's so rare for a memo to be filed in connection with a sitting president or even someone of this high profile. But again, it's filed with the court, as far as I know, it becomes a public document once it's filed. The sentencing is scheduled for December 12th. So, when I handle cases, everything we file with the court becomes publicly available.
All right. What do we learn from these memos that we didn't already know?
We know that that Cohen is being charged with three federal campaign finance violations, and that the government believes that he committed those violations at the direction of the president, or of Mr. Trump before he was president. The violations are, concealing, well, first of all, recruiting a corporate source of a contribution. That was the American Media Incorporated contribution. They own National Enquirer to buy the rights to Karen McDougal's story. It's illegal for a corporation to contribute to a federal election campaign. And the key here is they believe the purpose of purchasing her rights through this company was for the purpose of influencing the election. Number two, that Cohen made a $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. That exceeds the campaign contribution limit for a campaign. So that's a violation. And number three, the willful effort to hide these contributions, to disguise them through a shell corporation, for example, that's a failure to disclose. That's a violation. So this is essentially a roadmap for a future, potential future indictment of the president, to the extent that this shows that they think Cohen was working at the president's direction when he violated these three different aspects of federal campaign finance law.
Okay, but settlements like this, where you pay somebody not to say something, happen all the time. So is it the fact that this happened as part of a campaign that makes it illegal?
That's what the government is alleging. They're alleging that this was all arranged shortly before Trump announced for the presidency, therefore that all of these steps were taken for the purpose of influencing the election. And President Trump will do in his own defense if he's eventually charged with these same crimes after he leaves the White House, because sitting presidents can't be indicted, he'll argue that Cohen did not act at his direction. He'll argue that if he did act at his direction, that it was for the purpose of protecting his family, not for influencing the election.
So that's an important distinction then. If he argues that I paid these women off because they were lying about me, number one, and number two, I didn't want my family to be affected. It had nothing to do with the campaign. This is something I would have done whether I was campaigning for president or not. And he will probably argue that, in fact, the only reason these women threatened to tell their story was because I was campaigning for president. So they essentially forced me into it. Wouldn't that be a legitimate defense?
Well, it's a defense that could persuade a judge and a jury. I mean, these payments were made before he had declared for the presidency before he had announced his campaign. However, it was only shortly before, so the timing matters. When John Edwards was accused of paying hush money to the woman who, you know, bore his child out of wedlock, that took place, I think it was over a year before he announced for the presidency. So that's a factor. But purpose does matter because, you know, and the federal government understands it matters because they're arguing that all three of these steps were taken to influence the election. So that'll be up to ultimately to a fact finder like a judge or a judge or a jury.
Okay, but in terms of disclosure, this was his own money. It wasn't like he was taking contributions from supporters at the time, right?
Right. Well, Cohen paid Stormy Daniels with his money. The question is whether he was, you know, basically funneling money from Trump. Was he reimbursed, if you will? Yeah. So that's the key there. The American media payment, you know, National Enquirer, that was their money. And that's why it's a violation, because it was corporate.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Rob, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Can you successfully learn in your sleep? Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. This is something out of Brave New World. Didn't the oppressive government use sleep learning, or I think they called it hypnopedia training, to plant ideas in people's heads as they slept?
Yeah, that's true, Dave. The notion of being able to learn while you sleep or to be able to influence people's thoughts while you sleep is actually hundreds and hundreds of years old. But it really kind of gained popularity as even just a concept, like you said, with Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And actually, there have been intermittent scientific experiments of, you know, various degrees of rigor over the past century, trying to see if it actually works. The paper that just came out, it was the cover article of Scientific American, where two scientists who have spent their careers studying this have developed something they call targeted memory reactivation. And it's important to know the different phases of sleep. We have being awake, and then we have three other different periods of sleep. We have non-rapid eye movement sleep, which is really when we're not, very light sleeping. Then we have something called slow wave sleep. And then we have something called rapid eye movement sleep, is when the majority of dreaming occurs. Now, forever, it was thought that nothing happened during slow wave sleep, but these scientists found that actually slow wave sleep was one of the most important periods of time. And they noted that there were really dramatic differences between the different sleep phases, and that the slow waves of deep sleep really dominate the early part of the night. And during slow wave sleep, some memories spontaneously reactivate. So whatever happened during the day, whether it was your studying or your events during the day, that you would have this slow wave sleep. And it was during this period of time that that information would come back into your brain and it would then be stored. So if they could add another sense, stimulation of another sense, during the period of time of slow wave sleep, that they could actually enhance learning. And so these researchers used sound to do it, whereas the previous researchers have used smell to do it. But actually, it's worked with both.
It links to other sensations. How do they go about doing that?
So they did a variety of studies where, for example, the first thing they did is they looked at spatial memory, so where things are. And so the first thing they did was they taught people the locations of 50 different objects. Mm-hmm. And, for example, they might learn to place a cat at one designated spot on a computer screen and a tea kettle on another place on the computer screen. And at the time that they placed it, they would hear a corresponding sound. So, for example, they'd hear a meow for a cat or a whistle for the tea kettle and so on. And so after this learning phase, the participants then took a nap in the laboratory. And during that period of time, they monitored their brainwaves, their electroencephalogram, their EEG. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make sure that the individuals were actually asleep. And then when they detected the period of time I just mentioned, the slow wave sleep, they would play the meow or they would play the whistle and the other sounds that were associated with whatever objects they were teaching them. And what they found is on awakening that people remembered the locations when they were cued during sleep better than places that had not been flagged during the experiment. So whether it's sounds or whether it's odors that served as the cues in these experiments, apparently they triggered the reactivation of spatial memories, and so they reduced the ability to forget or increase the learning.
So that makes sense to me because if you're trying to memorize lines, for example, the human brain has a lot of stuff in stored there. but it takes a stimulus to bring it out. So most actors I know will stand in the wings and not even know what they're going to say next, but they're confident they'll say the right thing because they've rehearsed and they know that when that cue comes up, it'll trigger that memory. And isn't that the way the ancient Romans used to memorize speeches? They would read a speech as they walked around the house, or they would count fingers on their hands to signify phrases and would use that to memorize. That's why you have the phrase, on the one hand, on the other hand, because they would memorize speeches that way.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think people have always used other tricks like that to help them remember things. But this is actually using them and then enhancing the use of those tricks while they're sleeping. If you can do this, and if we are able to learn or enhance our learning during sleep, well, to what degree can it be used in terms of treating people in other settings? So, for example, could it help people reduce addictions? Or could it speed people's recovery from illness? One interesting study that's taking place at Northwestern University with the neurology department there is that they're testing a novel rehabilitation procedure for recovering arm movement abilities after having a stroke. So in this case, cue sounds are incorporated as part of the therapy and then are replayed during sleep to try and accelerate relearning of the lost movements from the stroke.
So you do your therapy while a certain sound is playing, or maybe even music, and then while you're sleeping, they play the music, and so the memory of the therapy comes back?
Yeah, Dave, that's exactly right.
Wow.
It's fascinating.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
For years, we have been discussing the thousands of untested rape kits in this state. First official statewide count recently found nearly 10,000 of them either still in evidence or at the lab awaiting testing or in process. But Kyria's Hannah Scott says an event tomorrow, which she's going to attend, could lay the groundwork for finally making some significant progress.
That's right, Dave. Getting the accurate count of untested kits just this October was a really big step. But there are other major roadblocks, including the 1 to 2 years it can take the State Patrol Crime Lab to test a kit, staff shortages, and funding. I told you earlier this year about Ohio clearing its backlog of 14,000 untested kits with the help of a super efficient high throughput lab that cut that testing time down to just 25 days. Tomorrow, lab scientists in our state will get an up-close look at those efficiencies at the State Patrol Crime Lab in Vancouver in a special training session set up by the State Attorney General Bob Ferguson.
Because the state needs to do a much better job, of processing these sexual assault kits. And the purpose of this event is to bring in some folks who can help the state have a more efficient system and bring justice to many victims across our state.
Ferguson is bringing in a top DNA expert for the training.
She spent her career working in this private forensic industry, supporting efforts really around the country and around the world, as I understand it, to prevent and eliminate these DNA backlogs. And she's the expert at improving processes, making sure that as we expand our lab to meet needs, that we do that in the right way, the most efficient way.
And that includes taking a very serious look at following the Ohio model, which this DNA expert helped to set up.
Ohio has been able to address their backlog by a big investment, more labs, but also more of an assembly line processing of these kits in a way that is appropriate from an evidence standpoint, but also is simply more efficient. And we have a lot to learn from those folks.
The goal for this training?
The goal is to have a lab in Vancouver that is higher functioning, an ideal lab, a dream lab, so to speak. And Ohio has been able to do that, and we believe with the right resources, we can do that here as well.
So the idea is she will do this training, she will meet with our lab scientists that we have at the Vancouver lab, and then in a few weeks she's going to put out a report that will highlight what he calls a dream lab, everything we need from new equipment to staffing to funding to make our lab similar to what we've seen in Ohio, where they can have that quicker process and get it down to a 25-day turnaround as opposed to up to 2 years to do just the one kit. Now, while there is an ongoing better than expected revenue for the state and a surplus, there are going to be some major budget asks this session, especially for mental health. So they're looking at about a $6 million ask for this lab equipment and things right now. So how much of a priority will the rape kit backlog be?
It's always a tough question to answer, right? My feeling is that it should be, you know, for reasons you've covered in your reporting, right? Each of these sexual assault kits that remains untested, sometimes after years, is an individual story, right? A victim story. And it's hard for me to imagine something that's more important in state government right now than making sure that we address that backlog and get those stories told so there can be justice and accountability.
Now, as for getting that $6 million,
$6 million in the context of our state budget is very, very modest indeed to address such a significant issue. And many of our issues, you mentioned mental health, they can seem intractable, right? They're just so complex, so many players. How do you really get your arms around it? The investment is massive. For this issue, there is a list. There are specific rape kits out there that have not been tested. There's a lot of them, but it is a finite number. We can address that and solve this problem.
So in addition to at least showing some respect for what happened to these women, does this mean that there's about 10,000 men about to get a knock on the door?
Well, and there's who knows? You know, some of the oldest untested kit is from 1982, so some of these people could be dead.
Yeah.
Some of them could be repeat offenders, which we've already seen multiple times in this state and several other states. I think Detroit, when they, in clearing their backlog, found multiple serial sex offenders who were serial rapists. So who knows how many are repeat offenders, but we'll get some answers for sure finally. Some of these, again, are decades old. So, and it's not just this. This lab is also very important for our major crimes DNA testing, which is also starting to see its own backlog. And we're talking murders and things of that nature here. Now, both the rape kit backlog and the murder major crimes DNA backlogs, State Patrol says that's a public safety issue. We've got to have a better lab.
Absolutely.
We have to. So I'm excited by this progress, by this training. He didn't wait for the legislature to do this. The AG found this budget money in his own budget to hire this expert, and this is the most significant thing I've seen in a while. So we'll
and
see.
You're going to be
I am going to be down there at the training, and I'll bring you everything I learned back when I get back next week, later in the week.
All right, it's Hannah Scott.
A little cool down from that commentary, your dose of kindness. Brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. The Bellevue Police Department is working this holiday season to change the perception of law enforcement.
Unfortunately, nowadays, there's so much negative incidents that get shared and viewed that the good stuff kind of gets lost in that mix.
That's Bellevue Officer Craig Hanaomi, an 11-year veteran. 4 years ago, he saw a need for homeless families moving into traditional housing.
But they don't have anything in there. Basically, whatever their belongings that they have at that time is what they move in with. And, you know, many people, I'd say nobody has any furniture.
So he helped the police department team with local nonprofits that were able to provide furniture. But then getting it to the homes became an issue.
Unless the person had their own truck or their own moving situation, they couldn't bring the, like it was a couch or a bed or box spring, they couldn't bring it.
So Officer Hanaomi had an idea.
I forget if I even asked permission for it, but the property van that we use for transporting evidence and stuff like that, I asked to borrow the keys for it, and I think at that time it wasn't like an official thing we were doing, but I was like, well, we have a van, we could help move stuff.
Just use the evidence van. And it worked. And ever since, the Bellevue Police Department has helped nonprofits deliver furniture to a handful of families each year. The first year was 2014, and they pulled off a Christmas miracle.
We moved everything in by Christmas Eve. Like, that was the last day. So they went from having nothing in their apartment to a pretty much whatever they needed, including, I think, even some presents.
And he believes being able to help in this way will make a long-lasting, positive impact on the relationship between the community and its officers.
It's a great thing when we can take an opportunity to connect with a person, especially a young person, when stuff is not going wrong. And I feel like that goes a long way, because if they see us any other capacity, like in response to 911 calls, the only time they will see us is stuff is going wrong.
There you go. Local officers doing some good. I always like to share local doses of kindness as well. I pull from everywhere for these stories. But if you know something happening in your community, maybe in your own family, I had somebody contact them about how kind their mother was and all of those examples. You can find me. You can email me. COBrian@CairoRadio.com. You can email the inbox at MyNorthwest.com or text us at 98973. Love sharing these stories.
Seattle's Morning News, this is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You may have heard that the big chill has suddenly hit the Seattle housing market. It was only a matter of time. To give us his perspective on that, here is Matthew Gardner, chief economist for Windermere Real Estate. I mean, before we talk about the chill, the other big news is that the Seattle Planning Commission has come up with a plan to upzone at least parts of the single-family neighborhoods around Seattle. You've seen the plan. What do you think about it?
It's long overdue. quite frankly. I mean, we're in a situation right now where 75% of the city is zoned single family. That might have been appropriate back in the 1950s. Is it appropriate now? I would say absolutely not. So when you talk about housing affordability, and that's the crux of the issue, unless we can start bringing in more housing, and the lower base is certainly lower cost, then it's going to be a problem for us. And that's where we're at. Seeing these changes, I think it's a good start. Is it going to have any immediate effect? Absolutely not.
I was going to ask you that because I saw the map, and there's not a lot of land area being upzoned.
Yeah, exactly. And so until we actually see it, what the effect's going to be over time, and that's the most important thing. But you've got to take a step forward. Affordability is a significant issue in Seattle. And it's a significant issue not for just for people that want to live here, but for companies that want to move here. All of a sudden, they're going to look and say, how much do I have to pay my staff?
Yeah.
Biggest component of salaries is cost of living. That goes up. They might think about, you know, Boise, Idaho might be a better place to be than Seattle.
Is there any way to build affordable housing without a subsidy? I was talking with an expert about this, and his answer was, no, whether you're a nonprofit housing organization or a for-profit housing organization, you have to have some sort of municipal subsidy to build affordable housing. Is that true?
It is absolutely correct, yes. And if you the way you look at it, there's certainly four corners to housing: land, labor, materials, and regulation. So you can look at labor, very, very expensive. A lot of people have got out of construction, so labor costs have risen. Material costs continue to rise at about 0.5% per month. Regulatory costs, well, for every dollar spent on housing, regulatory costs account for about 25%
wow.
of that. So it's massive.
Well, so let me ask you, though, can I just sort of poke some holes in that? I mean, is part of the problem, let's talk about regulation. I mean, there are some people who can't afford a house that's built to code. Is there a way to build houses that are safe, but maybe aren't as, don't have to have every possible insulation requirement, don't have, so you have people living in these little tiny homes now.
Yeah.
Right? Why can't you build larger projects which allow, you know, small dwelling units that may not be luxurious, but can get people out of the rain?
Well, yeah, that's true. But when you talk about the best insulation, these kinds of things, it's less that. It's far more cost for permits, cost for concurrency. There's additional costs which come in. Just pulling a permit's remarkably expensive.
Does it need to be that way?
No, it doesn't. But however you speak to any city administrator, they love that revenue.
And so, okay, they love the okay. The thing is, they love the revenue, but in collecting the revenue, they're creating a much more expensive problem for us, aren't they?
Absolutely right.
So it's not, it doesn't make any sense, even from their point of view, if you look at it.
Right. But what they're going to end up doing before they do anything else is saying, how can we increase density? Because if you increase density, you're lowering the residual land values. What you're doing is saying it's less land cost per unit.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than having a city where the zoning is anything from average lots of 9,600 square feet down to 5,000, that is still very substantial. You can only get between, shall we say, 4 and maybe 7 units per acre. So if you can increase density, you can actually bring down that cost.
Mm-hmm.
And building smaller houses is certainly an important component. We need it. We need it for multiple demographics, not just young families that don't need the McMansions. They don't want the 3,000
yeah,
square
right.
feet. But also our retirees and pre-retirees looking to downsize. They want to stay in the city. They want single living. They've got issues with their hips. So,
right.
And because of that, I think if we start looking at it in those terms and not just say it's single family or it's high-rise, because high-rise development does not solve any issues because it is remarkably expensive to build.
I hadn't thought about that. So what is the ideal building look like is in terms of a solution to the housing crisis?
I'd like to see far more townhomes,
mm-hmm.
duplexes, triplexes, ADUs we're already seeing.
Accessory dwelling units, as in mother-in-law apartments.
That's correct. Small cottages. And so we've seen these things.
Cottages. So how small? What are you talking about?
We were looking about a 12 to 1,400 square foot cottage.
Mm-hmm.
You can end up probably getting somewhere between 10 to 12.
It's the kind of thing my parents would have bought when they were newly married.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So there are ways around it. And I think we need to do that.
So for people who are out there waiting for rents to drop and for things to become affordable, can you give them hope?
I think in terms of the rental market, it's going to be very geographically specific. So are we in a bit of a bubble? And I hate to say the word, on South Lake Union Apartments. I personally think we are, just because we're delivering a huge number of units over the course of the next couple of mm-hmm. years at north of $4 a square foot in rent. So 1,000 square foot unit, $4,000 a month.
Wow.
So I think we'll actually see some correction. We already have seen some correction in that respect. We're seeing a lot of concessions starting to come back into play. 1 month off on a 12-month lease, these kinds of things. So we're starting to see that, but only really in the urban cores. In terms of overall house prices, I think last couple of months, we've certainly seen significant softening. There are some out there that are projecting a bubble, a major correction in housing values. I don't see it. Certainly, we reached a peak in terms of affordability or the lack of affordability.
Mm-hmm.
There must be a ratio between home prices and incomes. We broached that. We breached it, rather.
Yeah.
So at that point, I expect to see a softening. Does it mean that house prices are going to correct on the downside? No, I mean, housing is not a stock. You shouldn't look at it on its value on a day-to-day or even month-to-month, or quite frankly, on a year-to-year basis. It's shelter first and an asset second. So looking at short-term shifts on the downside, am I worried? No, I'm not. Overall, I tend to look at other indices rather than the average price or median price of units that trade in a period. So the Case-Shiller index is a great index in that respect. So it looks at the sale of the same house over time. That's still showing us up by 5.5-6% annually. That, I think, is a long-term average, which we've seen certainly in King County over the course of the last 20 years. We will continue, I believe, along that path. But we have reached an issue with affordability and home prices, therefore, adjusting. We're also seeing a lot more units coming on the market. A lot of people are trying to time the market. Now, invariably, when you get a lot more supply, you've got a still decent demand, that causes home prices to soften and home price growth to soften. I think a lot of those will trail off this month, as they classically do in December. Big question is going to be, is how many more units we see coming online in the spring market? And if it's a lot, but the bottom line is you've got to look at the economy. Our economy is remarkably robust.
Yes,
it's going to
that's
stay
a good
there.
Thing.
And it really is, all things being equal. And we can look at tariffs and these kinds of things as being some fairly major headwinds and certainly applicable here because of Boeing. But the economy here is doing remarkably well. I mean, probably one of the best performing economies in the country today. That's not going to go away.
Good.
So because of that, there will continue to be demand. But home price growth and homes are increasing in value by 10, 12% per year. That is unsustainable. It doesn't work. To drop down into that mid-single digits, that's been the long-term average. That's where I expect to see it. But you are going to see some short-term volatility.
Matthew Gardner is the chief economist for Windermere Real Estate. Matthew, thank you.
You are more than welcome.
You're listening to Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning to you. I'm Colleen O'Brien, as you just heard, Sully at the traffic desk. A little Pearl Jam music here. You can never underestimate the healing power of music. For many foster kids, music might be the only constant they've had in their lives. And for Pearl Jam guitarist Mike McCready, it's been a lifelong passion. As Cairo Radio's Ursula Roytein tells us, he jumped at the chance to help some aspiring musicians produce a song.
As the guitarist for Pearl Jam, Mike McCready is in his element when he's on stage with other members of the iconic Seattle rock band. But when he invited five young aspiring musicians to Pearl Jam's studio to create a song, McCready admits he wasn't sure exactly what to expect.
I didn't know what I was going to do exactly, Ursula, when I got there, because I didn't know what they could do or what their strengths and weaknesses or what mine were, you know?
For many years, McCready has worked closely with Treehouse, a nonprofit whose goal is to help give foster children the opportunities and support they need to become successful adults. All five of the teens he was going to mentor had experienced or are still living in foster care. When Sergio arrived at the studio that day, he was a bit starstruck.
Just seeing him, it freaked me out a little because I was so happy.
Ricardo also had to calm his nerves at the beginning.
I don't know what chords are. Like, you told me, oh, play C or G. I don't know what that is.
McCready says the young men came to the studio with all the ideas. He just helped them shape everything into a working piece of music. And with his mentoring, it only took a couple of hours before Ricardo was beatboxing and playing the guitar on an acoustic hip-hop ballad called Try So Hard. The song is about perseverance. The words tell their story.
I didn't really have family when I was a kid. And I don't know what family means, but listening to music helped me. And that's what made me realize that music is my friend. It's my family to me.
The song's lyrics include these lines: "There's no mistakes to be made. There's only room to be great. Every time you make a move, let it be by your fate." MacReady was blown away.
There's a message within those lyrics that talks about making mistakes, but they're not mistakes. They're opportunities. And that's something we can all learn. That's something I need to learn every frickin' day, you know, that a mistake is an opportunity for growth.
For Sergio, being able to collaborate with the guitarist for Pearl Jam was an experience he will never forget.
I learned that even though he's popular and he's a big rock star, you know, he's just like the rest of all of us. He's human, he's fun, you know, he's smart and everything. It's awesome.
MacReady insists he got more out of this experience than the teens did.
It changed my perspective in terms of like, wow, these kids are creating music and they've been through such dire circumstances with abuse and addiction or neglect. And they're creating this really cool music, and it's important to them. I will always cherish that day, and I hope we get to do it again.
You can help make the holidays bright for youth in foster care by texting MAGIC to 98973.
Song starts. So that directly from the Foster Kids of Washington State, thanks to the help of Mike MacReady from Pearl Jam. This is 30 years of holiday magic here on Cairo Radio, and every year we tell you the impact that it makes for thousands of kids in foster care in King County and throughout the state. So we really encourage you to get involved. Text the word MAGIC to 98973 to find out how you can help and make the holidays bright for kids in foster care. Throughout the 30 years, we've delivered more than 164,000 gifts across Washington State, and that's because of you contributing. Things like $15 can fill up a backpack with pens and notebooks so they don't go without at school. Pay for a graduation, cap and gown, pay for piano lessons, things that maybe you and I, Sully, took for granted.
Oh, yeah, totally. Got to do it. It's, you know, Treehouse. I mean, yeah, it's amazing.
They do great work. So again, text the word MAGIC to 98973 to find out how you can help foster kids this holiday season.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You're certainly familiar with the Weekly Standard, especially if you're a conservative, founded by Bill Kristol. It was funded by Rupert Murdoch. And now it is reportedly shutting down, and not because it's unprofitable, but for other reasons. A contributing editor of the Weekly Standard is longtime Wisconsin talk show host Charlie Sykes, who wrote a book called How the Right Lost Its Mind. Charlie, why is it shutting down?
Well, I certainly don't want to overstate what I know, and I don't know a lot. There's a lot of uncertainty about all of this, what the owners are going to do. But one report suggested this is not a natural death, that the owners have made a decision that they want to expand a sister publication that has been more favorable to President Trump than the Weekly Standard. But we don't know. But what I can say is how really unique the Weekly Standard has been as a conservative media outlet that has not gotten on the Trump train. And I think the moral courage of the editor, current editor Steve Hayes, you know, really needs to be pointed out, that he really was willing to stand up, stand athwart what was happening to the conservative movement. And he and the magazine may be paying a price for that now.
Explain where people like you stand. Would you consider yourself Reagan Republicans?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a long time ago. I call myself a contrarian conservative. The Republican Party has been thoroughly Trumpified. So there's a lonely group of us who still consider ourselves conservatives, who are not willing to compromise all of the things we believe, whether it's about free trade or whether it's about fiscal conservatism or about America's place in the world or about the role of character. We're just not willing to surrender all of that in this current era.
Do you feel that is the problem Trump's policies or his style?
It's a little bit of both. And it's not style. The problem with Donald Trump is not style. It is a fundamental issue of character and of judgment and of what he represents and what he is willing to embrace. Now, are there policies that he has enacted that I would agree with? Yes, there are. However, you have to ask yourself, at what price? What is the cost of all of this? What are you willing to give up in order to get, for example, tax cuts. And for a lot of us, including, and I certainly cannot speak for all of my colleagues at the Weekly Standard, that price is simply too high.
But he was the choice of not a majority, but an electoral majority of the people. So there must be something else, and of a lot of conservatives. So there must be something going on among conservatives. And I know his approval ratings aren't, you know, George H.W. Bush post 1991 high, but as the president keeps pointing out, they're hovering around 50%. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there is a cluster of conservatives in the country who like what he's doing, who want him there. So what's your message to them?
That we respectfully dissent from that.
Yeah.
His approval rating is still historically low. I mean, he cites the one poll, the Rasmussen survey, which is something of an outlier. And I would point out that just a month ago, his party suffered historic defeats in the midterm elections. The 40-seat pickup by the Democrats should be a serious warning sign to Republicans about the direction that the country is going. And I guess, again, we need to have a discussion of what does it mean to be a conservative? What does it mean to stand for certain values? And again, how far are we willing to go to defend and rationalize and enable some of the behavior of this president?
Charlie, do you think a Republican should challenge him for the nomination?
I do. In fact, I wrote a piece for the Weekly Standard, A Speech in Search of a Candidate, which I tried to imagine what would a conservative Republican challenger to Donald Trump in the primary sound like? What should they say? What themes should they emphasize? I'm not naive enough to think that is going to be easy, but I do think that someone ought to give Republicans who are more comfortable with someone like George H.W. Bush than with Donald Trump, give them a place to go, a place to take a stand.
So does this candidate have a name besides Unicorn? I mean, do you have an idea?
That was the word I actually used. I actually said I'm not naive enough to think I'm going to get a unicorn for Christmas. No, there is no name. That's why I said it is. I begin the speech with, good morning. My name is TBD. Is it going to be Jeff Flake? Would it be Ben Sasse? Might it be John Kasich? I simply don't know.
Let me ask you this. Since we're talking about a lot of people running, you know, our own Governor Jay Inslee is apparently seriously considering running. And I'm just curious, as somebody, you know, who isn't located here, have you heard any buzz about him?
Given the number of Democrats that are running, there's buzz about everybody, but it's hard to break through. It's hard to even get a handle on, you know, who's serious and who just simply wants to be mentioned. So I can't say that I've heard a lot.
Fair enough. Charlie Sykes, contributing editor for the Weekly Standard and host of the Daily Standard podcast. Charlie, thank you very much.
Thank you.